All right, this is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. Here on KEPW, LP, 97.3, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. All right, today, hot off the press, recorded 2 hours ago here at 2 o'clock here in Eugene, Tom Bivens, cartoonist, political cartoonist Tom Bivens, on satire and political cartoons. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. A very compelling lecture on political cartoons by Tom Bivens here on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Support independent radio in all its forms. And thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Coming up, Tom Bivens. River Tree Museum and Casino, built on the site where an actual ancient rainforest once stood, see a full-scale replica of a Douglas fir tree. See pictures of trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. Trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest will sing to you in our chamber of taxidermy. Hear the disaffected sounds of Feller Butcher and his bunch of fellers, an all-ex-logger band, in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Oregon Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit, turn right at the stump in the road, and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Free parking, kids a buck and a half, closed during summer months due to melting asphalt, giant locusts, and methyl ethyl hydroxy colchicine slag emissions. Brought to you by BJ's Bottled Air, the only bottled air manufactured in a plant powered by the very charcoal it's filtered through. Each bottle comes with a free trach tube ribbed and lubricated for pleasurable insertion. Pick up some BJ's Bottled Air today while you still can. Brought to you by Silt River. Brought to you by Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium. Do you still think women and people of color are inferior? You think corporations care about people and the environment? You think George Bush doesn't know the lyrics to the Horse Vessel song? You may be suffering from terminal ignorance. Made from 100% Amanita mushrooms, Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium actually removes the brain plaque associated with terminal ignorance. Pick up some today before it's too late. Side effects are compassion, forgiveness, and hysterical laughter.
Cover a much broader spectrum. I mean, they cover social issues as well. Political sticks mostly with politics, which is a good thing. In this country, it's been a part of our culture and history for a very long time. It goes back to the Revolution, certainly the Civil War, and beyond that. We'll talk a little bit about the late 19th century in a minute. And it doesn't matter how controversial they are, they're protected as free speech under the First Amendment. That's it. So if you don't like it, too bad. Okay, one of my favorite late cartoonists, he was tragically killed in an automobile accident some years ago. Doug Marlette described political cartoons as the acid test of the First Amendment. And that's a fact. Okay, so what about cartoons? Can they be satire? Yeah, that's why I'm here. I teach a class in satire right now. It's one of the most fun things I do. It's been called the oldest form of social commentary. It's been around since the Greeks, at least. In fact, the two most formal types of satire named after Greek scholars or philosophers. One of the things they noticed is that if you start with comedy, you can get people to pay attention. And this has proved true about other things like offensive advertising. If it's funny, people tend not to notice the stuff they would think is offensive. There's a huge study done in the UK about 10 years ago. They did about 20,000 people, and they found that if it's funny, they don't care that much about the offensive stuff. If you laugh at it for satire, you say, well, this isn't all that powerful. I think it's funny, but then you're getting a message at the same time. And it gets you to pay attention to issues you might ignore if you didn't have this to look at. Satirists, as Jonathan Swift once said, hold a mirror up to the flaws of society, and it helps you think critically about things you might otherwise pay attention to. He also said that satire is a mirror that we hold up to a mirror that we see ourselves in, except you never think it's you. I think he was right. Okay, some misconceptions. Satire very often combines anger and humor, and that can disturb people. That's why a lot of people don't like satire, because it's unsettling. And it's essentially ironic or sarcastic. It's often misunderstood. People just don't get it. They say things like, it's not funny, or that's in really bad taste. It's because they don't get it. Stephen Colbert, back when he did his own show instead of on CBS late at night, he had a persona that he developed as a satirist of a conservative, fairly right-wing pundit. And he kept that up the whole time he was on the show, never changed. During his interviews, never changed. In public, never changed when he gave talks. He was that person. It was a piece of satire. People knew it. That's why they tuned in. Except that when George Bush was president, the Republican Party, or the Republican, the group that sets up the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they invited Stephen Colbert. He said it was the quietest audience he had ever played for. So see, that's good satire. Also, that's this one. The satirist supports the policies that they're actually doing the satire about. That's what trapped Colbert into that one. He was flabbergasted. He had no idea. Here's one. Back in 2008, this was Barry Blitt, who's one of my favorite satirists and artists, did this cover. And the Democratic Party and Obama's campaign people were all upset. And David Remnick, who's still the editor there, he said, it's a satire. Come on, folks, it's a satire. We're poking fun at the way the right wing sees him, not you. You know, the American flag burning in the fireplace, Osama bin Laden's, you know, the fist bump, the artillery, the whole thing. This is satire. Folks, get over it. It takes a certain level of sophistication to understand satire, and that's why a lot of people don't get it. You know, because as Mark Twain once said, mostly people who live in the world are stupid. He was just a grump. Now, you can't mistake that for anything other than satire. This is a British publication. It came out during the campaign in 2016. Nobody would look at that and say, what? No, this is, you know, clearly. First of all, that's not a real person. That's the Liberty, the Statue of Liberty. Unfortunately. So what is offensive? Pretty much everything. Everybody's offended by something. I teach a satire class, and one day out of the term, I always say, I want everybody to tell me something that offends you. And most people don't want to say something that offends them. Well, that's because you have to understand students today. There was a research study done about 5 years ago, and it was called Lost in Transition. It was about people from like 18 to 23. And they surveyed 50,000 young people. And the first chapter of the book was on morality. Now, which is, I'm an ethicist, that's what I do. It was on morality, so I just read that chapter. And they discovered that students today tend to be subjectivists. They're afraid of judging other people. And they don't like talking about the things that bother them. And I test that in class all the time. I said, if you sat next to somebody who cheated, would you report them? No. Uniformly, no. So it's not too surprising. Michael the Adder lost his contract with 4 Canadian newspapers because he drew this. Now that's hard stuff. That's hard stuff to look at. It's beautifully drawn. He's a great artist. But it's hard. And he was literally fired. New York Times International Edition stopped using all political cartoons because of this one. One person did it, and everybody got fired. Now, you could see how this could be anti-Semitic. I mean, you can tell. It's easy to see this. It's in the picture. I wouldn't have done this, to tell you the truth. But because one person did it, and they had a bevy of cartoonists who did the international, they fired them all. And of course, the cartoonists got ticked off. Patrick Chappet, who's a great artist, he said, political cartoons were born with democracy, and they're challenged when freedom is challenged. Oh, Siri's trying to talk to me. She thinks I'm asking questions. It's a good thing I didn't order something. Order lunch for the entire room, Siri. Here's one of the things that came out afterwards. This is, you know, the Guardians of Our Cherished Civilization, New York Times. Don't find your irreverent humor and childish scribbles worthy of our esteemed pages. Our fragile backbones and delicate eyes can no longer countenance your trying satire. Thus, we are eliminating all cartoons forthwith. You know where we stand. Cartoon is down the bottom. Yeah, I do. And this one. So, a lot of cartoons, a lot was written about this. So, since this is partially about Ralph Steadman, let's ask Ralph what he would say. There can come a stage where what you are producing is just irresponsible graffiti, for which there's no point, but working as a responsible satirist, you would seek to produce something that is very funny in some way. Now, I've seen a lot of his work. Some of it just isn't funny. It's still satire. He said just recently he's going to stop drawing. I said, yeah, sure you are. He said, 35 years ago I thought I would change the world. He said, I did. It's worse. He's still pretty funny. So his targets have tended to be men who abuse positions of power. Now, in satire circles, we call this as punching up. The idea of satire is the idea of journalism. Get with the people with power and tell them what they're doing wrong. And satire is supposed to do the same thing. Truth to power. This guy, it's been that way here for quite a long time. Toward the end of the 19th century, the 1870s, this guy, whose name people refer to as Boss Tweed, was the de facto head of the government in New York City. He was part of the Irish gang. He set up business at Tammany Hall. He got away with pretty much everything. Until Harper's Weekly and its resident cartoonist Thomas Nast started drawing pictures of him. And this went on only for about 2 years. And here's what Tweed said. stop them damn pictures. I don't care what the paper's right about me. My constituents can't read. But damn it, they can see pictures. Well, they didn't stop, and within a couple of years, he was out of office. Everyone who worked with him was voted out of business, and he went to jail. So cartoons have an awful lot of power. So what constitutes punching up today? Has it changed at all? This is Ronald Reagan's latest close-up. Now, this is a Ralph Steadman piece. And he has made a living out of punching presidents, all of them. I couldn't find a decent one of Bill Clinton. I found a lot of Hillary, though, but somebody else. But in any event, all the way to George Bush and all the way to the newest. See, this motif of the Statue of Liberty shows up a lot in satire these days. You can see how this can be disturbing. Stedman's style is amazing. He never draws anything. He picks up a brush full of ink and slings it on a big piece of paper. Then he works from that. He's inspired by that. So this is how he does it. This is Statue of Liberty takers. Some people don't like his work at all. This is called Donald Trump Porky Pie. Now this is disgusting. He's got pig's ears. He's got like blood splash all over him, and God knows what's coming out of his pants. So this is stuff, and people look at this and go, that's not funny. Well, maybe. Here's what Stedman says. To offend the right person is its own reward. To get that response from someone you almost feel, it's a compliment. But choosing the right person to offend is perhaps the most important part of the job. But it comes naturally to me. I don't like bullies. I try to insult them if I can. So he's got a lot of people he can pick on. Because of its unique power to communicate, as Ludwig Wittgenstein, because I'm an ethicist, I actually know who that is. Wittgenstein once said, the only thing of value is the thing you cannot say. And he takes that seriously. Sometimes you can't communicate the idea or the emotion, but you draw it, and then you can communicate it. Because editorial cartoons are a unique combination of words and images, and symbols especially. So then the question arises, how far can you go? To the rescue, Mr. Fish. There's a great, great new film out on him, and it was shown at the library. At the museum on campus just last year. It's a great piece of work. Anyway, his name is Dwayne Booth. He's an equal employment offender. He's objective about who he cartoons about. Now, as a cartoonist and an illustrator myself, I am fascinated. His work is in pencil. When I first saw his work like 10 years ago, I thought it was photographs. It's not. These are all pencil drawings. He spends hours. And if he gets like 2 days into a piece and decides he doesn't want to use it, he has to finish it. He's obsessed with finishing his stuff. And he's prolific. Now I wasn't sure who I was going to be talking to today, so I kind of, this is tame. Now one level down from this, I will actually show my students. Below that, I won't even go. But he has stuff that is bound to offend anybody. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. Hillary Clinton briefing the new envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now remember, when you say that America is making great strides in the war, make sure you're facing away from the press. We don't want anybody to lose an eye. New. Joe Biden reassuring voters that his propensity for smelling the backs of women's heads will in no way interfere with his commitment as president to uphold and continue the 21st century Oval Office tradition of expanding covert hostilities all around the world and always considering the health and well-being of the financial district when making policy decisions that affect the lives of citizens, oh, not citizens, consumers. So I'm, like I said, he's an equal opportunity, you know, offender. He can offend anybody.
Will you read that?
Yeah. Fearful that his family separation policy is sending the wrong message to America, the president decides to show everybody just how much he loves children. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, you're in your brief free, or I'll find and deport them myself. Now this is grotesque. And some of his work is much worse than this. Yet he has gallery showings. But no, very few magazines or newspapers will publish his stuff. Harper's finally quit. They ran his stuff for years. Yes, ma'am? Yes, he is. He's on Toothpick. Yeah, and he has his own website called Clown something. And his stuff, he has a Facebook page. He puts new stuff in it all the time. Yes. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. But you know, in the film that was about him, a lot of it was his wife complaining that he didn't make enough money to support his family. In fact, by the time the documentary was done, he had just quit working at a Safeway store, making signs at night for sales. Some people find his work distasteful. But as he says himself, you're trying to warn a population against approaching doomsday. You don't want to make that clever and cartoonish. You want to make it that ugly and worthy of disdain. You want to hit people hard with satire if the subject is serious stuff. It doesn't have to be funny. Because I think if what you're doing is under the umbrella of satire, you have a responsibility to avoid making it just about finding the punchline, because mirth cripples rage. Skip the punchline, get to the point. Most of his stuff, I don't say most of his, a lot of his stuff isn't funny. He has a range of styles, from like just hand-drawn cartoons to serious, you know, depth. And he can do anything with it. One of my favorites. I found one today that was relatively new on his website. I really wanted to bring it in, but I couldn't do it. It was a little too hard-edged. I loved it, but I'm strange. So, who cares, and why? Snowflakes care. Arrange. I need my safe space. And political cartoons are yucky and offensive, the New York Times. So political cartoons run a range of people who don't like them for all kinds of reasons. They don't like them because they're saying the wrong thing. They don't like them because they're too tender. And they don't like them because of the New York Times. And one of my favorites, because it's close to home, the attack on campus free speech. This is real, folks. This happens. You know, I started teaching a satire class 2 years ago, and I was afraid that students would start reporting me to the dean. Because I teach an ethics class, and I've been called up a couple of times. Did you say something about Jesus? Yeah, do you want me to explain that in context? But my satire class, first time I've ever put what's known as a trigger warning on a class. Have an actual image of a metal sign with writing on it that says, satire is designed to offend people. If you're easily offended, drop the class now. I don't want to hear about it later. You've been warned. We all remember this one. What Ralph Steadman called an overreaction to satire. But do you remember this? This is what they were doing. This represents those poor young women who were kidnapped by Boko Haram, who impregnated numbers of them. Many of them took refuge in France. And this is them upset because they're not getting their welfare checks. And one of my favorites, one of their cartoons likened the victims of the big Italian earthquake to food. Penny with tomato sauce, Penny with cheese, lasagna, stacks of people packed under a fallen building. Now, this, you know, this isn't funny. I don't find this funny. Now, they're equal opportunity offenders. They take on the Catholic Church. They take on Judaism. They take on politicians. They take on everybody. And they say, just because we don't like anybody in power, don't give us a hard time. Now, not as simple as that. Is this punching up? No, it's not. As far as I'm concerned, I agree with most respectable satirists that truth to power is what you should be doing, not punching down to people who can't defend themselves from your so-called humor. Gary Trudeau, you all probably know who he is, Doonesbury. He had an acceptance speech. He got the George Polk Career Award, which is for writers, which he was the first cartoonist to get this award a couple of years ago. And it was happening right at the time of the Charlie Hebdo killings. And here's what he said. By punching downward, by attacking a powerless, disenfranchised minority with crude, vulgar drawings closer to graffiti than cartoons, Charlie wandered into the realm of hate speech. He got beat all up by other cartoonists and journalists and people like that. You know, they tried to get him to back down from that. They have him on morning talk shows, all kinds of things. I honestly agree with him, but he got a kind of a bad reputation, like he cares. He's got a whole bunch of money and he's still publishing the cartoons. Now, here's a good question then. Is there a line that a cartoonist or a satirist should not cross? Nobody tells you there's one. Mr. Fish, in the documentary, he said, you don't know there's a line until you cross it. And you need to decide what you're going to do about it next. So nobody says that you can't cover this, you can't say this, you can't do this part. One of my favorite people, Joe Sacco, graduated from the School of Journalism at the University of Oregon. When we draw a line, we're often crossing one too, because lines on paper are a weapon, and satire is meant to cut to the bone. But whose bone? What exactly is the target, and why? Those are excellent questions for anyone who does satire. Excellent questions. Actually, anyone who does persuasion for a living. These are great questions. He does great graphic novels and what's known as graphic journalism. Beautiful stuff. So this brings me to my personal philosophy, which agrees with his. I didn't steal it from him. I did mine before I read his stuff. Anyone in the business needs to ask themselves, who am I potentially offending and why? And you know that if you have a brain at all. If you're a satirist, an artist, a persuader, advertising, public relations, you know already who you're going to offend. Why then do you do it? Just because you can say it doesn't mean it should be said. That's the difference between the law and ethics. There's a difference. This is what's known as normative ethics. It says what you ought to do, not what you must do, and not what you can get away with. So that's the real question. The First Amendment allows you to do it. That's the law. Your conscience takes over from there. That's ethics. So because you can do it, doesn't mean you need to do it. You should do it. There's a newspaper on campus. It's still there. I noticed the other day. Somebody left a copy. Oh, golly, way back when the first Danish cartoon scandal happened. The Student Insurgent, which is a conservative publication on campus.
It's not conservative. It's not conservative.
Well, they're not conservative. Oh, you were at my last talk. The Student Insurgent published a cover that had a picture of Jesus on a cross with an erection. And the inside copies had all kinds of cartoons like that, in the same vein. And When they were asked why they did it, they said, essentially, because we can. We wanted to show people that we're not going to go out and riot because you say something negative about our religion. Because you can is not the right answer. The First Amendment allows you to do pretty much anything. And I'm not an absolutist. I think the last time I had to talk about cartoons, I had a bunch of people on the panel who were absolutists when it comes to the First Amendment. One of them said, they said, you believe in self-censorship? I said, of course I do. I mean, that's what ethics is about, self-censorship. You shouldn't be forced to self-censor. That's not self-censorship. And then a graduate student got up and said, that's anti-First Amendment. I said, no, that's actually pro-First Amendment. I get to decide what I do. Just because the First Amendment doesn't say you have to talk, it says we're not going to interfere with it. It's that simple. So you don't have to do anything. So the first time I taught a political cartooning class, my students came up with these commandments. They had only come up with 7, sorry. Don't draw without a political or social purpose. Don't be a wimp. Pick a side, take a position. Don't draw to please anyone. Don't be a sheep. Draw what you believe, not what society tells you to believe. Then the caution side. Don't be hateful or malicious. Don't be afraid to offend, but consider the consequences and evaluate the importance of what you're doing. And have an eraser handy at all times. I thought this was very good. I just asked them to come up with commandments, and they kind of all clustered into those areas. And I was happy with this. So to leave you with
irreverence is the champion of liberty and its only sure defense. Mark Twain.
My favorite person, about 200 drawings of him in my computer somewhere. That's all I have to say, but if you want to see anything else, you can find me at that. And I have about, 200 caricatures I've done over the last 3 or 4 years. One summer I just started doing, I finally gave up at 45 and had to go back to school. So my last one was Will Rogers. And he said, I like to match words with images. And he said I would never belong to any political organization. I would never belong to an organized political, I'm a Democrat. Yeah, it hasn't changed much since the 1930s. Okay, thank you for being attentive.
KPW 97.3, Low Power FM, Eugene, Oregon. Peaceworks Community Radio.
Yes.
This is Tom Bivens.
Differentiate between propaganda, satire, and hate speech?
Sure. No problem. Well, since I study propaganda professionally, academically, that's easy. Propaganda is always one-sided. Satire can be polemical, which means I have a point of view and I'm not going to cover anything else. It's a given with that. You know they're biased. All political and editorial cartoons have a bias. That's just part of the practice. Satire is that way too. Propaganda is designed specifically to do something. It's usually more than just one thing. I also just wrote a whole chapter on World War I propaganda in the United States and the uses of women in the images. Hate speech, that's hard. You know, I look at something and I say, that's hate speech.
But they use a lot of cartooning and graphics.
Yeah, they do. What's interesting is, there's a, I believe, Professor Young, correct me if I'm wrong, on campus we have like some sort of regulation or guidelines that says no hate speech or something like that. Nobody's ever been called up on it. You know why? It's not against the law. That's why. And it's not against the law because the Supreme Court can't figure out what hate speech is any more than they can figure out what obscenity is. So I'm not even going to try. Yeah, I know I want to see it. Bonnie Stewart.
We've got new technology. I'm asking more about technique than anything else. Do you encourage people to, this looks like maybe that's technologically done, but that's all hand drawing that you do, or?
Nope. It's a combination.
Okay.
I use photographs. I have Socrates, Aristotle, you know, people I've never met, don't have photographs of. And I use statues, I use etchings, I use drawings from the 17th century. I use things like that to get a feel for who these people are, and then I work from there. And I work, I quit drawing stuff a long time ago. I work almost exclusively on Photoshop and Painter, and a couple of drawing programs. I take my iPad Pro to all my faculty meetings and do cartoons the whole time I'm sitting there. I mean, what else are you going to do? So, no, I'm heavily into technology. Now, my brother, who actually makes a living as an artist, he draws all the time. He can't sit down without a pad and a pencil. And he's really good. I mean, he's younger than me. He got better than me right away. So, I don't sell my stuff. I give it away usually. And I mean, it's pretty good stuff. Every now and then somebody will say, can you do this for an ad or something? And I can do that. But he sells it. He needs to make a living. I teach for a living, so of course I'm loaded.
But you do your own drawings as well.
I do my own drawings. I have tons of them. I have stacks of paper. That's my wife. She wants to make sure you know I actually draw.
Actually, that's
right. I can actually draw.
So my issue with self-censorship, if you could elaborate on that, is that journalists, in attempting to be non-biased, they end up not getting to the truth.
Mm.
And in my opinion, there's no such thing as non-biased. You're always going to have a perspective. So can you elaborate a little bit on self-censorship?
Sure. For a cartoonist, for instance, Dwayne Booth, Mr. Fish, he can't sell his stuff. And I know why. Everybody knows why. All the syndicates know why. He asked Daryl Cagle at a cartoon agency. Cagle syndicates like 12 or 1,300 cartoonists. And Daryl Cagle said, Dwayne, if you just calm down a little bit, you can say the same thing without offending somebody. And I always tell that to people who go into advertising. I say, you don't have to do that. You can sell that product any way you want to. It doesn't have to do that. And so self-censorship, as far as I'm concerned, is a correct use of the First Amendment. I get to decide what I want to do. Now, if it's forced, if you're forced to do something from outside, that's not self-censorship anymore. So you have to ask yourself, those guys from South Park, when they were doing images of religious leaders, and they put Muhammad in, and they got death threats and all kinds of stuff, and then they put Muhammad in a bear suit, they still got death threats. Then they decided to do it anyway, and Comedy Central wouldn't run it.
So you actually might reach more people if you have a little bit of decorum.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, my students came out of the documentary on Mr. Fish feeling, wow, what fortitude that guy has, what integrity he has. He won't give up the way he works, you know, to keep from offending people. He also doesn't have a job. You know, he's got twins and a wife who's mad. So, you know, self-censorship. It works in small doses.
Well, you mentioned the First Amendment quite properly, and the problem with doing so is it's like the Second Amendment. People don't really know what it says. And the First the First Amendment, I think I pointed this out earlier this week, is negatively framed. It says, Congress shall make no law. And so it doesn't say, you can say whatever you want to, whenever you want to. That's not what it says. And we had, I think it was, I'm not sure the time interval, cartoonist, register guard, Wiley, his non-sequitur. Mm-hmm. And some people said, well, his First Amendment rights were violated. And I said, well, register guard has First Amendment rights too.
They're a private entity.
Yes, they're a private entity. So they can, and Facebook and Google are private entities as well. So they can do whatever they want to with Facebook.
That, of course, is why I'm an ethicist. you're absolutely right. It's negatively framed. It's one of those Kantian
first duties, they're all negatively framed. He had an elaborate reason in German why, but I just go with it. You know, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't kill, stuff like that. So, and the other ones that weren't perfect duties, those were just, you could do them if you want them, that kind of thing. But I don't, the only, it disallows the government from preventing you from speech and preventing the press from doing what it wants to do. Doesn't prevent any private individual from doing that at all. That's where your conscience should come in if you're a private company. And if, you know, if Facebook doesn't have a moral conscience, there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, Tom, when you say self-censorship, I'm pretty sure I understand what you mean. How would you differentiate that from editing? Because we all edit ourselves. We all use these filters to decide whether or not we're going to tell someone something.
It's the same thing. It's essentially the same thing. Self-censorship is editing, in a sense. And since most cartoonists, today at least, are online, there are only about 40 that work in newspapers in the United States anymore. Like 10 years ago, there were over 200. So they're not censored. I mean, Daryl Cagle won't carry Mr. Fish on his website. But you can look him up anywhere and see his stuff anyway. He's got his own. But if you don't have an editor, that's one of the reasons that that Gary Trudeau came out against Charlie Hebdo's work, and he said they didn't. They had editors, but they weren't really editors. They didn't say, "Oh, this is terrible. You can't do this." He said, "I've had editors my entire life. I've had strips, Doonesbury strips that were not published, that couldn't be published. Nobody would publish them, and I couldn't use them because the editor said, "No, you can't do that."
Well, Doonesbury now, it isn't on the comics page, it's on another page.
It is, it has been for a long time. So is Mallard Fillmore.
Prickly City.
Yeah, a lot of stuff like that. Because people don't think it's funny. It's satire, and for some reason they don't think the two things work together for some reason. I don't buy that. But comic strip is different than political cartooning, which is definitely designed to be satirical.
I'd like to know how you reconcile the fact that we have about a third of the population of this country who adores the person who has no self-censorship. And how do you reconcile that and not feel like you're the ultimate snowflake yourself? Because I'm right and he's wrong.
Because I have at least a modicum of integrity, and most of us have that. It's just that he wasn't born with it, and he wasn't raised with it, and he doesn't have any. He's never had any restraints or any filters, and he seems to be getting along well without it. And there are a certain number of people in the world who like to see that in their leaders because that's what they want to say. You know, they want to say, you know, bite me to the rest of the world. And he's doing that. But we're seeing the results of doing that. That's what diplomacy is about. Diplomacy is about not doing that. So it's there are people like that, and unfortunately, all we can do now is draw cartoons about them and vote occasionally. So, yes, sir.
Do you see a way for editorial cartoonists and political cartoonists to make money in the future?
Well, some of these sites, like Daryl Cagle, he sells their cartoons. So just like the old-fashioned syndicates, he will run them online. If you want to use them, you're supposed to pay for them like that. It's difficult to do. But it's been several years since that documentary actually came out, and he has since he has a Facebook page, which is fun to follow, but he has his own... I can't remember that, clown something, clown quacks or something like that. And then he's on, what's the other one? Yeah, Truth Dig. So they're still running and stuff and they're paying him for it. So that helps some. He's never gonna make a full salary doing it. Oh, and just to prove he's poor, he also teaches University of Pennsylvania, Annenberg School of Communication, University of Pennsylvania. So it's pretty prestigious. They don't pay much, but it's money. His wife's probably happy to be able to buy groceries, but it's a great family, twin daughters. Yeah, he's a twin. They have twin daughters who both are just as foul mouthed as he is. Because he's around the house all the time and his wife's at work full time. So what a dilemma for this poor woman. But they managed to get along. So it's an interesting family group. And on Thanksgiving, they go pick up boxes and boxes and boxes of food and distribute it to people stuck at home. So that's what they do every Thanksgiving and every Christmas. That's what they do as a family. And they can barely make it. So contemporary, that's what it takes.
But is there a future? His question back to
his No. question. I read a good long interview with Duane Booth, and he basically said editorial cartooning died with the death of the newspaper, the print newspaper. And I mean, the Washington Post still has four or five actually cartoons, two of which are really favorites of mine, but they're. They're rare. They're very rare. And I see students who want to go into cartooning, and I say, I have no idea how you make a living. Mr. Fish has done animation and all kinds of things to try to make a living. But if you're an artist, you're just not going to quit being an artist. You have to, my brother not only is an artist, but he designs web pages, websites, and things like that. He's very good at that, too. And that's a lot of his income. He does six or seven gallery showings a year in the Northwest, and he sells everything he takes. And so he's doing quite well. I don't sell anything. And I'm still doing quite well. I mean, I like what I do. And I realized a long time ago I needed a full-time job in order to indulge myself as a cartoonist and illustrator. I have a couple of children's books with my brother and things like that, and I do it for fun. When I'm tired and pissed off at the world, I sit down in front of my computer and do another caricature of somebody I like. And so keeps me going. If you're an artist, you can't quit. That's all I can say. So about that, anyway.
Just a search for more places to find stuff. Are there, I know about Funny Times, mm-hmm. but are there other printed sources to find cartoons or satire rather than just the internet itself?
Not that many. The university has something called,
just like Comic News.
Yeah, the graphic novel is a good place to find.
Thank you. Sunday, January 12th, is the next meeting of the Democratic Socialists of America, Eugene. This group meets twice a month at the Graduate Teaching Fellow Federation, 609 East 13th Avenue. This next meeting is Sunday, January 12th at 6 p.m. You can find out more on their website at dsaeugene.org/calendar. This Sunday, January 12th at 2 p.m., you can join the Climate Revolution's January Bike Ride.